The walk of God is by faith, not by sight. And it is revolutionary, edgy, frightening, but also exhilarating. There was an author a few years back named Bruce Wilkinson that wrote a book called The Dream Giver. And I would really recommend that book to you. If you like allegories like Pilgrim's Progress, it's very similar to that, but also with a little twist of Dr. Seuss, if you can believe that. But it's a great little story of about a man named Ordinary. And Ordinary is from a people called the Nobodies. The Nobodies live in the land of Familiar. And one day, Ordinary is given a dream by God, a dream to fulfill, a dream to pursue. And it gnaws away at him. He can't quite make anything of this dream because he's never seen anyone in his land of Familiar pursue their dreams. So he thinks about it. He goes home. He thinks about it. He's at work. He thinks about it. Eventually, he tells his friend, named, of course, Best Friend. And Best Friend says, I wouldn't tell anybody about that dream. That's a pretty big dream, and tell people about it around here, they'll think you're foolish. So Ordinary thinks about it some more. But the more he thinks about it, the more he thinks, I've got to pursue this dream. So he heads out on a journey, and he eventually comes to the edge of his comfort zone, where he sees a sign that says, leaving the comfort zone of Familiar, entering borderland. He starts to get really sweaty and clammy and anxious. It says, I can't do this. I'm heading home. But as he starts to walk home, he feels God tugging at his heart. He starts to get sad because he realizes that there on the border near that sign, that's where he left his dream. And he can't have his comfort and his dream, too. He has to choose. So he turns back and heads back towards the border, picking up his dream and heading forth on the course God has charted for him. He steps across the border, and he had heard rumors that once you cross that border, there's bullies waiting for you on the other side. But he never expected the bullies would be his own friends and family, people whose own comfort zones would be shaken if he leaves his, people who stand to lose something if this nobody suddenly becomes a somebody. But Ordinary pushes on. He comes to the Valley of Giants. He faces his giants of uncertainty, moneylessness, and rejection. Eventually, he arrives in the land of promise, where he pursues his dream of helping other people who are in poverty, and pursues his dream of helping other people pursue the dream that God has given them. Ultimately, he gives glory to God, who he calls the dream giver. Now, the story illustrates for us several important points. For one thing, God has a mission for each of us. There's something that God wants you to do, something that he's wired in you for his glory. And we may ignore that dream, or maybe we come to the border. We pursue that dream, we come up to the border, we come up to the line, and we know deep down inside that if we pursue God's plan, that things will go well, that there's something great on the other side. But so often we let uncertainty and fear paralyze us, not daring to cross over that line into God's promise. We can see it, we can almost grasp it, and we might even walk beside the line and be content with the fact that we have big dreams and we have good intentions, and those are good. But big dreams and good intentions are not worth much if we will not pursue them, if we will not daringly cross over that line and pursue what it is that God has set out before us. We have with us this morning many great examples of people who crossed the line, who went over that line and pursued what God had for them. Our military. Our military has stepped over that line. They've crossed the line, and they've been bold about it. You've answered the call. Many of you have approached that edge. And maybe you had some idea what you were getting into, but you didn't really have any guarantees. There was no guarantee, would you be safe? Would you make it out alive? There was no guarantee where you might be placed, what danger you might befall you. But you boldly crossed the line. And maybe that made other people uncomfortable. I wonder how many of you had someone try and talk you out of it and say, no, it's too dangerous. Or no one in our family has done this before. Maybe you should do something else. Some of you know personally what it's like to be on the edge of greatness and to cross over, and how terribly frightening, yet how terribly exhilarating that can be. Now, I want to share with you this morning a story of a military operation. We'll be looking in Numbers 13 and 14. Now, this operation was a spy operation. Here's the context. God has freed his people, Israel, and they're journeying to the promised land. God makes an order, and Moses communicates this order to all of Israel, that they need to send out spies. He'll take one spy from every tribe, a leader of that tribe, to be a spy. He's going to send them out into the promised land to check things out. Now, normally, if you're spying on an enemy for a military operation, you want to see if you can defeat them. Where are their weak points? What do we need to do to help them crumble? But certainly, Israel will have to step up to the battle here. But really, the real work that we see in this passage comes from God. Starting in the first verse of chapter 13, the Lord said to Moses, "Send some men to explore the land of Canaan, which I am giving to the Israelites. From each ancestral tribe, send one of its leaders." Now, how great is that? There's concepts that show up again and again in the Old Testament. One is, this is the land I am giving to you. The outcome's already decided. This is the land I am giving to you. But also, there's this phrase that God uses, says that the Lord goes out before us, that certainly Israel has to step up to the battle. They put on the armor of God. They go and they may have to even sacrifice. But God does the heaviest lifting in these battles. Whereas other people, the opponent, may put at the front lines their toughest men, their toughest artillery. Israel put at the front lines God. God went out before them. God blazed a trail before their battles. In Romans 8, verse 31, it says, "If God is for us, who can be against us?" And down in verse 37, "And all these things, we are more than conquerors through him who loved us." Now, returning to Numbers 13, verse 17, "When Moses sent them to explore Canaan, he said, 'Go up through the Negev and on into the hill country. See what the land is like and whether the people who live there are strong or weak, few or many. What kind of land do they live in? Is it good or bad? What kind of towns do they live in? Are they unwalled or fortified? How is the soil? Is it fertile or poor? Are there trees in it or not? Do your best to bring back some of the fruit of the land.' It was the season for the first ripe grapes." Now we skip down to verse 25. "At the end of 40 days, they returned from exploring the land." Now it's interesting to see in Moses' orders what he says and what he does not say. What he asks is, see if the cities are fortified, and also see if the people are weak or strong. So he does have some military strategy here, but there's no mention in here, nothing to indicate that Moses thinks it can't be done. He's just doing his part. As Israel will step up to do their part in the battle, Moses is doing his part here, but there's nothing to indicate any fear. If there's going to be any fear in this mission, it did not come from God. It's not a spirit of fear from God. It's not from Moses. He's simply gathering details. But also he asks about the soil, and he asks them to bring back some grapes. So you almost get this image that Moses isn't only planning the attack, but he knows it will succeed, and he's saying, okay, there's going to be a vineyard, and that's where we're going to plant a garden, and that's where we're going to set up camp. Moses is almost setting up the household in his mind. He's planning for a victory. In his mind, he knows it will happen because this is what God has promised. In verse 26, "They came back to Moses and Aaron and the whole Israelite community at Kadesh in the desert of Paran. There they reported to them and the whole assembly and showed them the fruit of the land. They gave Moses this account. 'We went into the land to which you sent us, and it does flow with milk and honey. Here is its fruit. But the people who live there are powerful, and the cities are fortified and very large. We even saw descendants of Anak there. The Amalekites live in the Negev, the Hittites, Jebusites, and Amorites live in the hill country, and the Canaanites live near the sea and along the Jordan.'" Now, what the spies are doing here is they're listing out the worst of the worst. Think about our nation, for instance. If I was to ask you, what are some of the most dangerous people groups? You might say, well, maybe street gangs or hidden terror cells or mafia. We still have mafia. The spies are listing out here a who's who of the most violent of the violent groups, and they're all in this country. They're on the way. They have to go through each one of these most terrifying groups. So if you just read the text, it seems very factual. If you don't read the rest of the passage, you could say, well, they're just listing out the details. They were asked to get some details. They pulled together the details, but it's more than just what they say. It's also how they say it. They say that they list out the details, but perhaps they're stating it in such a way, in their tone of voice, in the way they communicate it, that would spark fear in the people. They probably were transferring their fears to the crowd. And the reason I say this is because down in verse 30, we know that Caleb has to silence the crowd. We have this image that the people are in an uproar. They're in despair. Also, we read later on in the passage that the spies, most of them anyway, don't believe that they can defeat the enemy. So it's not just what they say, but it's how they say it. I'll give you an example. Do any of you have any friends or family that are like that? And if you don't remember, I'm sure you'll remember as Thanksgiving and Christmas rolls around, that maybe you have somebody in your family, it's not really what they say, it's how they say it. And they say something to you, and you go over to your spouse or someone else in the family, you say, well, I can't believe what so-and-so said. Well, what they say, and you tell them, they say, well, that wasn't that bad. No, but you had to have been there. It's how they say it. And you can't really explain it because the person wasn't there. That's a little bit of what we have going on here, I believe. That it's not just what the spies say, it's how they say it. It's the spirit of fear in which they communicate that. They've gotten so close, they're arousing fear in the camp now, but they've gotten so close to the promised land, they've actually walked inside of it, they've seen what it is. It's the land that God is giving to them. They've come to the edge of the promised land, but they're afraid to cross that line. Their solution is turn back, cut their losses, let's hire a leader, and then we'll go back, except for two courageous men that God uses. Let's look down at verse 30. Then Caleb silenced the people before Moses and said, we should go up and take possession of the land, for we can certainly do it. But the men who had gone up with him said, we can't attack those people. They are stronger than we are. And they spread among the Israelites a bad report about the land they had explored. Now notice the wording there. It's a bad report. What makes it a bad report is not that they listed out the various enemies. That's just factual. That's not what makes it a bad report. What makes it a bad report is that they knew that God was giving them the land. This wasn't a secret that only Moses knew. God had said that numerous times before. It was public knowledge. They knew that God was giving them the land. And yet, they still have fear. They can't do it. God has performed many miracles. He's parted the water. He's led them by night as a pillar of fire. But still, they have a lack of faith. They see this threat of the other people as so insurmountable that even God can't get them through it, that perhaps God will not fulfill his promise. They go on to say, the land we explored devours those who are living in it. All the people we saw there are of great size. We saw the Nephilim there. The descendants of Anak came from the Nephilim. We seemed like grasshoppers in our own eyes, and we looked the same to them. Now, about the land devouring the people, some commentators believe that there was a plague going through the land. This plague went out before the Israelites ever got there. That's interesting, right? God goes out before us, and suddenly there's this plague in the land. That doesn't sound like a coincidence. That sounds like perhaps the blessing of God. A plague is striking the land, so it stands to reason that many of the men will not be able to fight or not be able to defend themselves as well. So it sure looks like God is going out before them and preparing the way, but they say, oh, the land devours the people that are in it. Also, they say that when we saw the Nephilim, we looked like grasshoppers in their eyes. Now, how did they know that? How did they know what the Nephilim thought about them? I doubt that the spies went to the local tavern, tapped on the biggest guy, and said, hey, me and my fellas, we were wondering which one of us could whoop you. To which the Nephilim would reply, well, you look like a grasshopper to me. Oh, let us tuck our tails between our legs and run back to Moses, tell him to report, we can't do this. They're so insecure, their insecurity is so great that they've put words into the mouth of their enemies and then they have been defeated by those same words. It's all made up. They've made up in their mind and now they're defeated before they've ever set out on the journey, which sounds ridiculous. But isn't that what we do? Ask yourself next time that you're traveling and you're going through unfamiliar towns and you stop at a sketchy gas station and there are people much bigger than you and they're looking at you, probably just looking through you, but do you say in your mind, oh, that guy's going to beat me up and take my car? Maybe all he's thinking, he's looking behind, oh, I could go for a coffee and a brownie right now. And you're thinking, they're going to devour me. Or maybe if you're in a crowded place, Do you ever look at people around you and you think that someone is out to get you? Do you ever assume that someone doesn't like you? I've heard this numerous times before. Well, so-and-so doesn't like me. Well, how do you know? Well, they gave me a dirty look. Was it really about you? Did that look have anything to do with you? And I'll tell on myself here, and you can relate, if you're married or been in any relationship, you can relate that your spouse, your loved one, can have a look on their face that has absolutely nothing to do with you, but you can read into it something that's not there. There's been times that I've gotten home and my wife, remember, is a special education teacher, and maybe she's had a student that gave her a bad day. They were off their medication, they came in, they ran up the wall. She's been dealing with that day. So I come in, she's got that facial expression of what she's dealt with, and I, at many times, have thought, oh, it's about me. I'm in trouble now. And I start going through the mental checklist, like, what did I do? Did I take out the trash? Did I break another coffee mug? Probably. So it's probably something legitimate. I'm just not sure which thing. And I find out it was really about the student. I go, oh, thank goodness. I'm safe. But joking aside, don't we ascribe to people emotions and motives that they might not even hold when it's not even about us? We act like people are out to get us. Like we can't achieve our goals because we think there's bullies on the edge of borderland. And maybe there are. Maybe there are bullies waiting on the edge of borderland. But we defeat ourselves before we ever get to the journey. We don't ever set out. We think, oh, I've already lost. Now, wouldn't life be easier if every time that God called us and we pursued his call, that other people saw what we were doing, we were following God, and they figuratively would lift us up on their shoulders. They would encourage us and bless us. Hey, I see you're sacrificing for God. That's great. And encourage us and send us on our way. And sometimes that does happen. But oftentimes, when we cross that line, we disturb our comfort zone. We disturb the comfort zones of others. We might be trying to pursue God's plans for us, but people can sometimes be discouraging. We might be called fanatic or freak, strange, and it can feel really lonely. And we can feel like we're the only ones standing up for God. It's very lonely that who else will stand up for God with me? But let's turn to Numbers chapter 14, and we'll see the answer to that question. That night, all the members of the community raised their voices and wept aloud. All the Israelites grumbled against Moses and Aaron, and the whole assembly said to them, "If only we had died in Egypt or in this wilderness. Why is the Lord bringing us to this land only to let us fall by the sword? Our wives and children will be taken as plunder. Wouldn't it be better for us to go back to Egypt?" And they said to each other, "We should choose a leader and go back to Egypt." Then Moses and Aaron fell face down in front of the whole Israelite assembly gathered there. Joshua, son of Nun, and Caleb, son of Jephunneh, who were among those who had explored the land, tore their clothes and said to the entire Israelite assembly, "The land we passed through and explored is exceedingly good. If the Lord is pleased with us, he will lead us into that land, a land flowing with milk and honey, and will give it to us. Only do not rebel against the Lord, and do not be afraid of the people of the land, because we will devour them." Now remember, they had just said, the land devours the people. But here Caleb is saying, we will devour them. Their protection is gone, but the Lord is with us. Do not be afraid of them. But the whole assembly talked about stoning them. Then the glory of the Lord appeared at the tent of meeting to all the Israelites. So here is Caleb. He's making a stand, and now he is joined by Joshua. And they're reminded that Moses and Aaron were already on the same page. We follow God. We know what God has said. So there's Caleb, there's Joshua, there's Moses and Aaron. And they're a small group, but they're standing up for what God has promised them. Now, in that day, you didn't send out an email or a public service announcement on TV. If you wanted to really drive home your point, you did something theatrical. That was pretty much all there was. So a lot of times we see prophets doing a dramatic act in front of the people to draw their attention and remind them to turn to God. And that's what we see here as Caleb and Joshua tear their clothes in an outrage. Now, tearing your clothes in that day would be something like banging your fist on the table. It lets everybody know there's a loud sound, there's something dramatic going on. These people have had enough. And that's what they do. And they make this great display to remind people that God has made a promise for us. Why would we turn against God? Why would we turn back? We've come up to the line. We can cross into greatness if only we will follow God. We certainly can do it. But the people in dismay want to turn back. They want to stone the messengers. And of course, no one wants to have that kind of sacrifice. But before it can happen, God weighs in on the issue. His glory shines at the tent of meeting. At the beginning of chapter 14, we see the people wailing and crying, declaring all the horrible things that they think will happen to them. As we look at the list, they think, we'll die in the land. Something will happen, we'll die in the land. Our children will go through torture or worse. We'll never see the promised land. And that's precisely what God gives many of the people. Just as the spies considered themselves grasshoppers and assumed the worst, here the Israelites are assuming the worst. So God gives them what they have prepared themselves for. He says, indeed, your bodies will fail in the desert, but not by their enemies, by themselves. Israel has defeated themselves. He says that indeed their children will go through a hard time, but the children will see the promised land. But not until after 40 years of wandering in the desert, 1 year for every day of the spies' exploration. So God makes it very intentional. They'll be stuck out in the wilderness for 40 years. And the message God is sending seems to be very clear. He lays out an opportunity for his people to take, and they can either take that and reap the blessings, or they can imagine a negative outcome and, in effect, let that be the outcome they've chosen. It's ironic that the very things that they are afraid of are what they have made happen to themselves. They have defeated themselves. And I wonder, are any of you living defeated right now? Now, as I look out, I see a lot of Christians who I know who are very strong Christians, and it seems like you have it all together. But don't all of us have that deep down inside of us, that part of us, that person inside that nobody else sees, that part that we're ashamed of, we don't want to let the rest of the world see, that maybe has doubts, that maybe has been called by God to do something, but we shrink away from it, and nobody knows. That can be a person that you know about inside of you that no one else sees, or it can be the part of you that you don't even see anymore. If God is calling you, he's calling you and calling you and calling you to pursue something, and you turn a deaf ear to it, it's not long before you don't even hear it anymore. I know many of you probably don't even hear the trains or the airplanes much anymore, or you just ignore it. It's just a background noise. It's like how the air conditioner in your home, you don't hear the air conditioner. You know it's on, but you don't hear it anymore. It's just static. It's just noise. And we can do that to the voice of God sometimes, where we say, well, I never hear from God. When God's been talking this whole time, we've just gotten very good at filtering him out. So I wonder who is living defeated today. If you live in defeat long enough, it becomes your norm. And you can even forget that you ever had a dream given to you by God, a dream to pursue. Maybe God is calling you to do something this morning. Maybe it's something that would be public, or maybe it's something just between you and God and only you know. Maybe it's something that you need to stop doing. Maybe it's an addiction. Maybe there's a pattern of being, of thinking, of behaving that's not healthy for you, and it's not good for your relationship between you and God. Perhaps you're on that line and you stand ready to cross over into greatness, into what God has for you. But you think, well, my family, my friends, they're not going to understand this. No one else that I know has done this. Maybe I'm the only one that thinks this is a good idea. If I step forward, here I'll be alone. I'll have to stand by myself in all of this. But let these scriptures challenge you to be a Caleb, to be a Joshua, to be a man or woman who stands up and says, we should go forward. I personally should go forward because God is on our side and we certainly can do it. As we sing this final hymn, I invite you to come forward in whatever way God may be leading you. Maybe it's to make a relationship with Jesus for the first time or to rededicate your life. Maybe it's to join the church. Maybe it's something else in your life that you just need to talk to someone about and let go of. Perhaps you're ready to finally cross that line and to fulfill what it is that he has in store for you. Perhaps that line is just a few feet ahead of you, and you just need to cross over that line to take that step in boldness. We invite you to do so as we sing this last hymn.